Hello, everybody. I'm Radio Johnny, and you are listening to Recovery Radio on KRFP 90.3 FM in Moscow, Pullman. Recovery Radio is an outreach of the Latah and Whitman recovery communities. You can find them on the web at latahrecoverycenter.org and on Facebook. The Latah Recovery Community is located at 531 South Main Street in Moscow. You can contact the LRC by phone at 208-883-1045 or by email at latahrecoverycenter@gmail.com. The Whitman Recovery Community is located at 226 East Main Street in Pullman. You can contact the WRC by phone at 509-715-1111 or by email at wrccprogrammanager@gmail.com. And the hours over hours in Moscow are 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. Monday through Friday. Open on the weekends for meetings only. You can find that on the calendar. And over in Pullman, they are open from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday. And Recovery Radio's purpose is to share with our community how addiction and behavioral health disorders affect us all and how we deal with them. We also share the personal stories of people in and around recovery, highlighting their experience, insight, and hope for continued recovery. And like I said earlier, I am Radio Johnny, and today I'm in the studio / conference room with Miss Denise. Hello, Miss Denise.
Hello. Hello, everyone. Glad you're all here.
Glad you're here, too.
Or listening.
Or listening. Yeah, if they were all here, it'd be very crowded.
Very crowded.
Yes. It's a small conference room.
Yep.
And the topic we're going to talk about today is triggers. This topic always comes up with people in recovery from not just substance use disorder, but it can be recovery from grief, all sorts of different things. You know, so I went out on the web and found this really excellent page here, and it was the upliftrecovery.com website, and so I'm going to read some of the stuff they had there, and it's titled Internal and External Triggers and 13 Examples of Each. What's inside? Understanding internal and external triggers in the context of addiction recovery. Insights on how internal and external triggers substance use can impact recovery. Strategies for managing both types of triggers. So recognizing and managing triggers is crucial for anyone navigating the recovery process from addiction. Internal and external triggers can dramatically impact one's journey toward sobriety. Here we delve into detailed examples of each, providing a comprehensive look at the triggers you might face and the strategies for managing them. Then it goes on, and first they're going to address internal triggers. Internal triggers refer to emotional or psychological states that evoke thoughts or cravings related to substance use. They originate from within and are often linked to personal feelings or memories. And the first one they have here is stress. And they define that as high stress, or not defined so much as they explain what stress can do. And they say high stress can lead to a desire for escape, often sought in previous habits of substance use. Stress management techniques like mindfulness and exercise are crucial in coping. And I don't know about you, Miss Denise, but I've dealt with stress on many levels, you know, in recovery. Jobs typically can be very stressful. The kind of work you do here. You know, you get to have intimate relationships with people, and they might have health problems or something, and that can cause a lot of stress in your environment.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, just being concerned for my peers and what they're going through and stuff like that. I would say that typically, it's been my experience that stress is where there's multiple things going on at the same time that are stressful. Like, it can be like, okay, there's this one stressor going on either at work or at home, but when there's like multiple things going on, or if there's a lot of things in one of those places, those can build up, you know. That could be a lot of different things, you know.
Right.
Your life, other people's lives, your finances.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it really can be a big gamut of different kinds of things. Yeah,
yeah, I've heard that, you know, we all have this stress bucket, and stress comes in drips and drabs. It doesn't have to be something overwhelming. It can be just, oh, God, I'm going to be 5 minutes late to this meeting. But it gets to a point where that stress bucket will spill over from all of it.
Right.
And that's when the issues really happen. You know, I can't cope with this. Oh, a drink will make me feel better.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And it can show in different kinds of ways, like how you feel or how you are interacting with other people and mm-hmm. stuff like that. For me, if it's becoming really, really overwhelming, or I can tell that it's starting to really like affect me physically, there can be, you know, tightness in the back of my neck or head, down the middle of my back. Like, those areas can just get
right.
really upset. And then also, I'll notice if I'm just not interacting and engaging as well with my words with other people, that's usually an indication as
right.
well. Yeah. And I think I read something recently that talked about, you know, with stress or fight or flight, there's actually chemicals that are dumped, or hormones. And you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
when they say in here about for stress, they say stress management techniques like mindfulness and exercise are critical in coping. The exercise and being able to process through those different kinds of chemicals that are being dumped is actually really important.
Right, right. And exercise,
I think I remember what kind it is, but I don't want to say it wrong. So,
well, there's
I think it's cortisol.
Cortisol is one of the things, and you can flush that out with exercise.
Mm-hmm.
There's also adrenaline, which, you know, is part of the fight or flight. You know,
yeah,
you get this rush of adrenaline, and that can also be calmed down with exercise. And mindfulness or meditation is what I would call it, you know, just calming, sorting those things out, you know, just taking a break from them for a minute. Yeah, because a lot of stressful situations will resolve themselves without your interaction. So, and sometimes we take on stress we don't own and we don't deserve. So
I usually just look up a 5-minute mindfulness video and just try to follow what it says to do and just relax my body and follow their prompting through things.
Yeah.
That's helpful.
That works.
Yeah.
All right. Number two, anxiety. Anxious feelings can push individuals towards substances as a quick relief. Therapy and relaxation techniques can mitigate this trigger. Yeah, anxiety, that's, you know, was my best friend. I used to have anxiety attacks when I'd get on airplanes. And drinking, it turns out, can actually make it worse.
Oh.
Yeah, I would find myself, you know, almost ready to pass out from the anxiety attack. And there's nothing like laying on the floor in a narrow aisle on an airplane near the bathroom and having people step over you.
Sounds very germy on that floor.
Yeah, yeah, it was.
But it was necessary at the time, huh?
Yeah, it was not fun. Mm. And then, you know, it gradually subsides. Mm-hmm. But yeah, dealing with anxiety can be, I mean, it can be anywhere from, you know, being anxious to go on a trip, you know, which is kind of a fun anxiety, kind of, you know, peps you up and stuff. But then there's anxiety that can be created, you know, from fear.
Yeah.
Things are going to go terribly wrong. I missed my car payment. They're going to come take my car back. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it can hit you on a lot of levels, including that, you know, a debilitating anxiety attacks where, you know, you get lightheaded. You feel like you're going to pass out.
You wind up at Crittman.
Yeah, you get that adrenaline rush, that fight or flight feeling going on, and it's hard to deal with that. Really hard to deal with that. And, you know, if it's something that's a chronic condition, therapy can help. Mm-hmm. Relaxation is what I use, just deep breathing exercises. So, you know, that does help short term. Next one is depression. And the heaviness of depression might make substances seem like a solution to feel better or to feel something different.
Yeah, that's a big one. That I can relate to that, and that makes total sense.
Yeah, I suffered from clinical depression for quite a few years in sobriety, actually. Although I'm sure I had it when I was drinking, but I was drinking, so that's how I dealt with it. But in sobriety, you know, it got to the point where I actually chose to get on antidepressant and go get what they call cognitive therapy, talk therapy. And it really helped me get out of it. It allowed me to kind of understand that just because I'm not really feeling like doing something, maybe if I just went ahead and, you know, bit the bullet, so to speak, and went ahead and did certain things, it would have a positive effect. Exercise was something that worked well for me, as well as the therapy. And then the medication also helped. But I got to a point where I felt like, you know, I'm not sure that I need this anymore. I'm not feeling the heaviness. I'm not wanting to sleep all the time. I'm not, you know, having those symptoms that I had, you know, a couple of years before. So I talked to my doctor and I said, you know, I think I want to try and get off this medication. And they don't recommend that you just stop cold turkey. So she laid out for me a series of stepping down on the medication. Take this many this day, this many the next day. And then over like the period of a month, slowly eliminated it so there wasn't a shock to the system. Because that can cause suicidal ideation, all sorts of things bad. And I slowly got off it, and I found that I didn't need it anymore. You know, a lot of things had changed in my life, too. I had retired from a stressful job. You know, just that one thing alone kind of took me out of a lot of different things, you know. Yeah. Blood pressure issues and all that stuff, too. So, yeah, so you've dealt with depression yourself, huh?
Yeah. I think my depression was more while I was in substance use, and that was hard. And I remember having, like, panic attacks and different kinds of things. So there was medication that I took every day and then medication that I took for emergencies. Yeah, I even took a vacation to Santa Cruz to kind of try to help, too, which was nice, but it didn't, you know, totally fixed the situation. So it took a little while, and then I was able to, I don't know how, for how many months, but it was definitely maybe 6 months or less.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was, were you taking your illegal medication along with the legal? Because that can be problematic.
Yeah, that was a while ago. I'm not really sure.
Huh?
I don't remember doing anything then.
Oh, so, okay.
Yeah. Just a hard, it was a really, really hard year.
Yeah.
Yeah. There were just multiple, the year started out with like just terrible things going on in my brother's family. It ended with my grandmother dying. There was just, it was a rough, rough year.
Oh yeah.
There was just so many overwhelming things going on. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That'll do it.
I just remember I wasn't in recovery. It wasn't in the last 11 years. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on. Boredom. Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Idle time can lead to thoughts wandering to past behaviors. Keeping a busy schedule can help manage this trigger. Oh, boy. When I first came in to AA, I went to every meeting I could possibly go to, and I got sober in the San Francisco Bay Area in the East Bay, so there were meetings
everywhere,
almost around the clock.
Nice.
Dawn to midnight, at least. And so I just kept doing that. And in those times, like maybe on a Sunday where there weren't any noon meetings and I might have to wait till the evening to go, I would just stay busy any way I could. It got easier when I finally got back to work and, you know, had to get up at 6 and
right. Be
at work by 8 and, you know, do my day at my job, because that was... you know, kind of filled things up. But, you know, there were still those times where I might even only have a few minutes and the thoughts would come to me. Oh, maybe you're okay now. Maybe you can have a, you know, a beer would be really good right now.
And that's, and it's rough that in your situation, it's at the grocery store.
Right.
You know what I mean? Right. That sucks. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, that's harder.
So yeah, idle hands are the devil's playground. I've heard that somewhere before.
Yeah. Gosh.
Loneliness. This is a big one. Without social support, one might turn to substances for comfort. Engaging in community activities or support groups can alleviate this feeling. Well, yeah. I mean, that's why there is such a huge, what we call a fellowship in AA. You know, it's a we program because we know we need community. Mm-hmm. We know we need people to talk to. And it reflects a lot on what you do with your recovery coaching.
It does. Yeah. I mean, humans were built to be in community with others and to spend time with others. So it's really important. So that change from when you are going from being in addiction to being in recovery, it was my experience that I had to make new friends. So a lot of, you know, some of the first conversations when people come in and they're trying to make these changes are, okay, let's introduce you to the areas and community that you would like to find new support, friends, and that kind of thing.
Mm.
Yeah, new fellowship. Yeah, it's important, and it can take a minute to do that because even fun, you have to figure out new fun things to do if you've been living in drinking and using for a while as a part of your social time or your fun time or your downtime or whatever it is. So it's a little bit of an adjustment period, and so you know, just remember to be kind to yourself. And if you're struggling with that, you can come in here and talk to somebody too.
Right. Yeah. I remember when I first got sober, it's like, oh, I'm never going to have fun again. As silly as that.
Right.
That
we
sounds.
We think that though.
Yeah. It was like, because everything I did that I considered fun revolved around drinking or drugging at one time. But I mean, we used to say, let's get all messed up and then ... you know, add your potential tragedy here. You know, riding motorcycles out in the woods or, you know, something foolish. You know, the isolation that also goes on, you know, particularly with alcoholics, when we're in the depth of our disease, you know, we don't want to be around people because people will just mess up our ability to drink the way we want to drink. So yeah, loneliness is a killer. Mm-hmm. Next one is fatigue. Exhaustion can weaken resolve. Maintaining a regular sleep schedule. I don't know what's wrong with my tongue today. Maintaining a regular sleep schedule and healthy lifestyle supports better energy levels and decision making. Well, yeah, if you're tired all the time. Now, I know it's not uncommon for people new in recovery to have horrible time sleeping. You know, it happened to me, and after like the second week of only catching, like being able to catch like an hour of sleep a night, I finally went to the doctor and I said, I got to get some rest. I got to do something. And he said, well, I'm going to give you like 5 of these pills and I want you to put your pajamas on, sit on the edge of the bed, take the pill, and immediately lay down. Mm-hmm. And I honestly don't recall what the medication was, but it knocked my butt out. I mean, I went to sleep, and then after the like third day, I decided, you know, maybe I won't take the pill tonight because I was tired. I've been you know, out exercising, doing stuff. I was busy that day, and I actually felt tired, kind of in a different way. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel exhausted. I just felt tired, and I laid down. I was able to go to sleep.
Nice.
So I never actually needed to go through all 5, but my body needed a reset.
Yeah.
You know, it just needed a reset from that. Because when I was drinking, I didn't really sleep. I would just, like, basically pass out for an hour or two, and then my body would wake me up when it needed more alcohol. Mm. So I would drink some more and then pass out for, you know, a few hours again. So, yeah, so fatigue is a big one.
Yep.
And when you say fatigue, you're not talking about being physically tired necessarily. It's the mental state.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah.
And when you're all fuzzed up, you can hardly make good decisions.
For real.
That's my case, mm-hmm. anyway. Hunger. A well-known trigger acronym, HALT. Hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Highlights hunger as a basic trigger. Regular, nutritious meals can prevent this. Yeah, I've always had like a weird eating schedule. It's like I'm not a breakfast person. I guess I was when I was a kid, but as I got older, you know, so for me, breakfast is like a cup of coffee and like maybe a banana, mm-hmm. something like that.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't have to go off to school, you know, and then have to wait till a certain time.
Right.
Like I felt like sometimes either with school or with work, I needed to make sure I ate in the morning because I would be starving by like 11.
Right.
You know what I mean? It just kind of depends on what your situation is. Yeah.
Right. Right. Even if you have an odd schedule like me, you know, usually by lunchtime, mm-hmm. I'm finally hungry.
Yeah.
And I will try and, you know, eat some protein with something green. And, you know, some carbohydrate bread, you know, something like that. And I do feel better. My mind is clearer. Hunger diverts your thoughts to all sorts of weird places. I remember going on a camping trip where we didn't bring a lot of food because we were going to catch a bunch of fish at this great fishing place. But it rained for like 3 days before we got there.
Oh, no.
So the river was literally brown with mud, and there was no catching fish in there. And we were like, basically we had been dropped off at a trailhead, hiked in, and weren't going to be picked up for another 3 or 4 days. So we wisely, you know, rationed the little bit of food that we did so that we could, you know, eat a little something to be able to hike the like 5 miles out of this canyon to where our friends were going to pick us up. Mm. But yeah, I mean, we were looking at all, you know, does anyone remember what Yul Gibbons said about, you know, you can, many parts of the pine tree are edible.
That's what I was going to say, like, can you eat leaves?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Right.
Oh, well, boy.
We were looking pretty seriously at bugs and stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm. I bet you were.
But the thinking that went on during that time mm-hmm. was also kind of loopy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. You throw hunger in on top mm-hmm. of angry, lonely, and tired, and
yeah, it's a mess.
You could be a little snappy. Next, anger. Oh, of course. Intense emotions often seek an outlet. Substances should not be one. Anger management classes can be beneficial. Now, I've never had a anger problem, I suppose you could say, but I've been angry, and I know when I'm angry, I do things and say things that are not pleasant. You never get angry, though, do you?
Oh, my gosh, never. I was going to say, anger with substance use is probably not a good idea. That could just probably get worse. Not a good idea.
Right, right.
Yikes.
Right. I mean, I've never gotten to the point of, like, well, I actually did when I was a teenager. This guy gave me this motorcycle or scooter type thing all in a box, in boxes, literally a frame and mm-hmm. with wheels and then like parts in a box here and there.
Build it, huh?
Yeah, and I was working on it, putting it together, and I couldn't get this one spring or something to go where it's supposed to, and I was just so pissed off. I threw a screwdriver and it ricocheted off the floor, missed my dad by about a foot, and then stuck into the garage door.
Yikes.
And my dad, who did have anger issues, just kind of looked at me and said, boy, you better get mm-hmm. that under control. And that was kind of an eye-opener for mm-hmm. me. So, you know, I've had those situations where I'm just, you know, ready to boil. And I just think about throwing that screwdriver. You know, it's like, okay.
Yeah, what could have happened?
Need to back off here. But I'm not above, certainly not above yelling when somebody, my wife, pushes my buttons or something. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, I'll raise my voice and I will get angry over it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, certainly it was a lot worse when I was, you know, out there using and drinking.
I think what I think of with that, with using, is that some types of drugs can cause rumination, I feel like. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it can just make things circle around more and more about whatever you're angry about, I think is what came to mind.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Not
well,
beneficial, because it's not going in any kind of a resolution or a processing positive direction.
Right. Well, we
at
talk
least for me.
We talk about resentments in AA, and usually they're centered around anger. Or there's anger is one of the symptoms that goes along with it. And we, you know, we talk about having a way to diffuse the anger, a way to stop and pause, pause before you, you know, act on something like that. Again, you know, not easy when you're using. Also, alcoholics have this wonderful thing called the magical magnifying mind. Which we can take a minor, say a minor affront. Somebody, you know, doesn't say hello back to us, and it's like, oh, they hate me. You know, what's the problem?
That's a fun one. I've done that before.
You've done that before?
Yeah.
You've had anger issues before?
I've done that before.
Oh my.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on from anger, frustration. Like anger, frustration can lead to old coping mechanisms. Developing new, healthy coping strategies is key. Yeah, frustration, you know, when your car won't start, you know, are you really angry or are you really just frustrated?
Yeah, that's fair.
Interactions with people can be really frustrating.
They can.
You know, you ask your kid to do something, and you come home 8 hours later, and it's not done.
Right.
Like, you've had that experience?
I've had that experience. I feel like this year's been going pretty good for the summer with my kiddos. They're a little bit older now, but I've definitely had that experience. Yeah. Cell phones are helpful because then I'm just like, hey,
yeah,
can you do this? And I want pictures.
Yeah.
Prove it before you
send pictures.
Send pictures.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think my wife, actually, it's kind of funny. She'll ask me to do something, and I'll send her a picture when it's done. Maybe she's got me trained.
Yeah, I mean, it's helpful.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I think that like multiple things in a morning or in a day can lead to frustration, too.
Yeah.
You know, just kind of like one thing after another. It's just like, really? Yeah. Can we start over again?
Exactly. And now we're on to low self-esteem. Boosting self-esteem through positive affirmations and achievements can reduce the impulse to use substances. Now, there was an old saying that people who have low self-esteem have generally earned it. In the case of alcoholics, or an alcoholic like me anyway, that can be true to a certain extent. You know, as our morals fade away, and our behavior gets worse and worse, and we allow it to do that, you know, it drags our self-esteem down. But like it says here, I think the key with building self-esteem is by doing esteemable acts.
Yeah.
Helping an old lady across the street, mm-hmm. You know, helping your neighbor take the groceries in. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't have to be earth-shattering things. You don't need to do Nobel Peace Prize-worthy acts to build up your self-esteem.
Right.
You know, because alcoholics also, we have to be a little careful about ego, you know, where that's where you have like an outsized sense of self-esteem. You know, I'm the best, I'm the greatest, you know. Mm-hmm. So building self-esteem, I mean, what are some of the things you do, Denise, to build self-esteem?
I was going to say, it comes to mind like learning and achieving things like they talk about, you know, improving your relationships with your friends and family, volunteering, just being a part of things and growing and learning, I feel like is good.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Because, I mean, low self-esteem can come from some childhood things where maybe, you know, you didn't have some guiding with parenting and stuff like that, or you had some bad experiences.
Yeah, sure. Like if people constantly tell you you're a piece of crap.
Right, yeah.
you know, after a while, you're going to start believing it.
Right.
So,
yeah. So,
yeah, that's where, you know, the opposite of people who have earned, you know, have earned it. You know, it can be just laid on you as well. And use of substances will do that as well.
Yeah. And I just want to say there are ways to work through those lies that we've taken on of things other people have said. So,
yeah. Exactly. Memories. Nostalgic memories of substance use can trigger desires. Creating new sober memories can help. Oh, yeah. In AA, we call it euphoric recall. Oh, you remember the time we all, drank that gallon of whiskey and then, you know, whatever. Because it wasn't always bad. There wasn't always horrible consequences. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, typically early on when people use substances.
Super fun. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember in high school getting a hold of some amphetamine pills. And, oh, God, we have ball with that. You know, stay up all weekend, have a great time. Of course, going to school on Monday was a little challenging.
That was probably a little rough, yeah. But you probably bounce back after a few days because you were young.
Exactly. So, I mean, you know, that euphoric recall can be really hazardous, you know.
Yeah.
So I, you know, when I think about back on those old times, the bad old days, as I called them, you know, it's like, yeah, it was fun, but then it wasn't, you know, it was fun till it wasn't anymore. And every time, you know, it seemed like every time I drank, once the wheels came off, I was trying to get back to that place.
Right, and it just wasn't possible anymore.
You can't get back there anymore. No. So, yeah. Physical pain. Oh, here's one we can both relate to.
Yes, we sure can.
Chronic pain should be managed under medical supervision to avoid self-medication with substances. Mm-hmm. Now, you are really dealing with this at this point.
I really am. And this go around the last, I don't know, at least 5 years of like really dealing with the same stuff I was going through in my late 20s, early 30s. I'm now, you know, doing with professional help and had spine surgery last year and was able to get through all of that in the correct way and everything. Going back in now, a year later to my doctor in a couple of days to be like, hey, still having a lot of problems. It's really like every single day it's affecting my life, my work, my quality of life, to kind of see what we can do, go get some more x-rays. I don't know. I don't really know what it's going to involve, but it's certainly not going to involve doing things illegally or in a way that's not doctor approved, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And so it's just been really good in recovery to be able to deal with pain in a non-destructive way.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I have, I'm old. So when you get old, things start breaking down. You know, my spine's been breaking down for years now. Mm-hmm. And I've got bulging discs and arthritis and all that other stuff. And, you know, I went through the whole regimen of the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. And I still do take them from time to time. But, you know, I had to be put on a I think they call it the baby aspirin of opioids.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I take a metered dose, you know, it's all doctor prescribed.
Yep.
And I go and see my doctor every 3 months.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we talk about it and we see how it's going. And he checks my vitals and, you know, makes sure that, you know, I'm not overdosing myself. And it's something that I could see as being a real problem if I didn't have the right mindset going into it.
Right, because you know through what you've come through with alcohol and stuff like that, you're wiser now. You know what things can turn into, so you're making good choices for yourself.
Right. And having the accountability of, you know, not only the doctor, but my wife, she would notice if something was up.
Right.
And, you know, my fellows in the program, I mean, they're all aware. Right. I mean, my doctor's aware of, you know, my past alcohol abuse, and you know, it's in my chart, you know.
Mine too.
But still got to keep an eye on it.
Yep.
This is an interesting one. Sexual arousals sometimes linked to past substance use contexts.
Yeah.
Recognizing planning for this trigger is necessary. So I'm not exactly sure.
Well, I feel like I can speak to it a little bit.
Yeah.
In my addiction, my spouse and I use substances to heighten our intimacy time. You know, so that could be something that could be missed for somebody, and they could maybe want to have that situation again. For me, I'm divorced. I'm not with that person anymore, so I don't really have those reminders because I'm not with the person I used to do that with.
Right.
So that kind of helps. And then, of course, you know, I'm if I were to date, then it would be with someone who is either never had a problem with those things or is well into their recovery, so that mm-hmm. that's not an issue. But I could definitely see for some people, you know, like I said, about speaking into couples that are, you know, struggled with that before and then could think about that. You know what I mean?
Right.
That makes sense. And I'm sure that there are a lot of other examples that other people could think of, but that's just the one that I can relate to. Mm-hmm. It says, sometimes linked to past substance use contexts, recognize and plan for these triggers is necessary. So yeah, I mean, again, you know, having that support group of people in your recovery is going to be really good. You know, mm-hmm. you could sit down with someone that you trust and talk through those things. You could seek professional help about those kinds of things. And then I think really, you know, if you're with someone, spouse, partner, whatever it is, and just talking those things through and remembering what they can lead to, you know. And it's kind of like other things where, you know, when we talked about fun and stuff like that, it took us a while to figure out what was fun without our substances.
Right.
I feel like it can go in the same lane with this. As you're doing things differently and not having those substances, your brain's going to rewire. Yes, you may think about those other things, but you're going to learn how to have fun and enjoy these kinds of things as well without it. It just
right.
takes time.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
It's like any of it in the beginning.
You know, that slipping back into substances, you know, could create that those sexual desires that aren't healthy.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it's really an area of yeah.
Yeah, it talks in the AA Big Book about years of living with an alcoholic. You know, can make you know, anyone just not want to, you know, be around their spouse.
Yeah,
and that spouse might go looking for something other than alcohol, the way they say it, mm-hmm. you know, in different places, and
right.
you know, that can cause, you know, as much damage to the relationship as just the alcohol itself.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
yeah, so I can see it kind of from that mm-hmm. aspect too. And you know what? We could dive into external triggers. But I think I want to save that for
next week.
Mm-hmm. Because I was talking with a friend of mine who about what we were going to talk about today. And he recently lost a child, 6 years old. His name is Chris, and he had two sons. Griff was the son that passed away. He had been ill, but, you know, there was hope that things could get better, but it didn't turn out that way. And also, he has another son named Beckett. So I asked him, I said, you know, in dealing with his grief at this time, what sort of things trigger him into being emotionally overwhelmed, basically? And he wrote me this, and he said, blood, how little things in a conversation make me think of Griff. Sometimes when I look at Beckett, he looks a lot like Griff, especially when he sleeps. Certain foods, like chicken wings. All Griff wanted to do is eat chicken wings. Tie-dye and rainbows he really liked. He really liked the color red, but rainbow was his favorite. So that's where it goes back to blood. And he works in a hospital, so that can be pretty common.
Yeah.
And he goes on, he says, when I see a PT Cruiser, which is a car, I think of my mom because that's what she drove. And he says, they blindside me and triggers hit when you least expect them. I'm learning ways to handle them when they do hit so emotions don't overwhelm me. When they do hit, I allow myself to feel them and process them in order to heal. Avoiding and stuffing them is the worst thing I can do because they will reappear with a vengeance. a lot like dealing with emotions in our disease. I told him I'd like to use what he wrote in the show, and he said, yeah, feel free. I would love for more people to understand how to process and work with your grief, which we did a show on, by the way, and I sent it to him, and he listened to it, and he said it was incredibly helpful, so good-o on that. So understand how to process and work with your grief. It never goes away. It becomes a part of me, and I move forward with Griff, not move on from him. And I that just hit me, because I never thought of it that way, you know, moving forward with the person who passed, as you know, having been a part of your life, and it's going to be a part of your life, right. You know, forever. Yeah. I mean, she's never going to forget his child, right? I'm never going to forget my friend Tommy who passed away, mm-hmm. you know, or all the people I've known in the program that have passed, you know, and my sister, I'm never going to forget her. So the idea of moving on with someone, mm-hmm. that's really cool. I really like that idea. And speaking of moving on, I think it's time to move on here because we're up against the wall. So next week, we'll look forward to talking about external triggers and what those things look like, because it looks like there's a list of 13 of them, just like the internal ones. And maybe we'll talk more about dealing with triggers and different ways that, different ways Denise works with, peers and people that you're coaching to help them get around that.
Yeah, that sounds good.
I really feel like I've dominated this show, but...
Oh, this has been good. Thanks.
But it's all working out. All right. So I think I'll close down with the usual. Thanks everybody for listening. And if you think you have a problem with substances or behavioral health, you do.
Being beat up and battered around, being sent up and I've been shut down, you're the best thing that I've ever found. Reputations changeable, situations terrible, but baby you're adorable, handle me with care. I'm so tired of being lonely, I still have some love to give, won't you show me somebody to lean on. Put your body next to mine and dream on.
I've been fucked up and I've been fooled. I've been robbed and ridiculed in daycare centers and night schools. Ports, terrorized, sent to meetings, hypnotized.